God, it's gorgeous out there. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is February 17th, Monday, President's Day. Actually, I think it's Washington's birthday. I'm not going to honor all presidents. They don't deserve it. And as you have come to expect, we're going to be beginning every show between now and November with the words of Colonel Vindman before Congress, where he assures his father he will be all right. Of course, as we've come to know, he is not all right. He was perped walk out of the White House, and now the Trump administration is going after him as well, perhaps even on criminal charges. So we're going to hear the voice of Colonel Vindman. And two other things I want to mention that you're going to be hearing. I want Michael Bloomberg to show us his tax returns. Okay, Michael, you're a gazillionaire, so let's see how you made your money. And the other thing is, Bill Barr, I think you should resign. And with that, Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. So I just want to share with you that while Donald Trump may want him to be investigated, this is a story from February 14th. The Army will not launch an investigation into a decorated officer who was a key witness during the impeachment inquiry into President Trump and then removed from his White House National Security Council position, officials said Friday. Not just removed, perped walk out. Let me put that language in. Yeah. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy said Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman will begin a stint at a military college later this year. I would love to take that class. Anyway, but he will be moved to a short-term assignment. In the meantime, McCarthy did not provide any details on the new assignment. We better be following Colonel Vindman, but you will be hearing his voice between now and the election. Remember Vindman in November of 2020. You are not all right, Colonel Vindman. The country is not all right. Democracy is not all right as long as Donald Trump is president of the United States. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to say this every day. I'm sorry. I'm Ken. I want to beat it like
Absolutely.
A drum. I'm going to beat it like a drum. I don't have the ability to buy billions of dollars of ads. I don't have a huge microphone, but I do have the ability to repeat. And I will repeat and repeat and repeat because it needs to be part of your electoral DNA when you go into the voting booth, because it is more than Vindman. We need to be all right. We need to be all right. And we will not be all right with Donald Trump in office. Okay, so how was your weekend and what's going on?
Yeah, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Exactly,
right?
How was the play?
Well, I am going to beat my drum, which is the border and immigration policy. And I just want to let you know that as of February 5th, the U.S. is sending people back to El Salvador. We're deporting people. And 138 people have been killed who were sent back to El Salvador by the United States.
Right.
They've been murdered down there. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is trying to get countries to agree that there'll be safe places for people to go back to. But the government of El Salvador said last week that El Salvador is not ready to receive migrants. It can't protect them. It can't keep them safe,
right,
as is proven by
how many
all of those
murdered?
People have been murdered going back there.
Right.
So, Mr. Trump, you're lying. Another thing that is interesting to know, and this is in our own backyards as well, the Trump administration doesn't like sanctuary cities, and they are trying to do what they can to squash sanctuary cities. New York is excluded from states that can go back and forth. But mm-hmm. also in Boston, mm-hmm. they are bringing in stormtroopers. They have these SWAT teams. Right. And I don't know if you've seen pictures of them, Marnie, but the pictures of these SWAT teams, it looks like, you know,
Gestapo.
Yeah.
Yeah, they look like
and
the Gestapo.
They are being trained to beat up protesters and drag them off.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievable. One good news thing to tell you about the border is that my colleagues down in Brownsville, Texas, went to the airport and protested the deportation of migrants trying to get asylum in this country. And they stood in front of the buses containing people that were about to be put on airplanes to be flown out of the country and deported. And they held their beautiful banners, and the police had to come and threaten to arrest them. And they got some visibility and got to be there at before dawn in the dark hours of the morning in order to be present for the deportations. But it was encouraging that people are really taking to the streets, as Greta Thunberg is
doing with on climate change. And I keep thinking about the Diary of Anne Frank. And I keep wanting to make sure that people understand, do you have a basement? Do you have an attic? You may be needing to hide people.
Yeah.
Hide people. Anyway, it is our Rethink the Week, everyone. I don't know who was on hold, but I just – someone called in. Anyway, so much to talk about. I cannot believe it has been less than a week since the New Hampshire primary. It feels like it was a million years ago. And having been so active in covering that primary, both for local and national and international news, I'm still exhausted. I will admit, I'm still exhausted, but we're going to be joined with our Rethink the Week with Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic and presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He, too, has been covering this really interesting presidential campaign, especially as it applies to the state of New Hampshire. We're also going to be joined by Mark Fernald. Mark Fernald is a former state senator. He ran for governor. He is a Mayor Pete supporter. He will be joining us. And then we'll also be joined by Stephen Pimper, who is a professor at UNH Manchester, as well as a CARSI fellow. His area of expertise is poverty and homelessness. And one of the reasons I decided I wanted three folks from New Hampshire is that because really the New Hampshire primary was just last week, it is an opportunity for us to both talk about what happened and sort of look forward as we see what's about to happen in places like Nevada and South Carolina and the impact of Iowa, frankly, on the New Hampshire primary, because Iowa had a huge impact. Let me just say this over and over again. It had a huge impact. And the reason I am saying that is that because it was so damn chaotic, because it didn't really give us guidance, because the app didn't work, because, you know, frankly, caucuses are kind of a group grope. I'm not sure they're even Democratic. Because of all that, there was so much pressure coming into the New Hampshire primary, one, to prove that we could do it and we could do it well, but also to prove that, one, we would get a huge turnout. It was a pathetic turnout, frankly, in Iowa. It was depressing on so many levels. We wanted to make sure that we had a huge turnout. We wanted to make sure that the numbers would be, you know, registered and accurate. And as I did on CNN with CNN 360, and I'm on the show, and I held up my my technology, and the technology I was holding up was my pencil to remind everyone on the CNN set that's how we did it in New Hampshire. We used a pencil with an eraser, and I was maybe not
and
only
we got results,
and we got amazing results very quickly. And I'm also suggesting that perhaps we use a pencil and an eraser in all the elections going into 2020, if nothing else. I don't have to worry about it being hacked. I mean, there may be some things about stuffing the ballot box, but that's a little bit old, and we actually know to sort of anticipate that. So joining me right now in studio is Dean Spiliotis. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Ernie.
And joining us by phone are our two guests, Mark Fernald and Stephen Pimper. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ernie.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning or afternoon.
Yeah, whatever it is. So I'm going to start with you, Mark. It's been a while. I think New Hampshire did its thing. We showed people we have the presidential voting muscle. People showed up in droves on both sides, frankly. You saw that Donald Trump got huge turnout for, you know, his reelect. And then you also saw that on the Democratic side, the Democrats actually, you know, outachieve themselves. It's the highest voter turnout for a Democratic presidential primary ever. And that is that's positive news. But what else did you sort of take away? I still can't believe it's not even been a week since the New Hampshire primary, because we have to look at not only what are we teeing up, but what did we sort of respond to?
Well, a couple things I want to say. First, not only was the turnout high by our standards, but our turnout in primaries is higher than any other state, and it isn't even close. Mm-hmm. We had 450,000 people. Or did I do that wrong?
No, I think it's actually higher than that. 500, I think that's right. I think the 550,000.
And then in November, we're expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 800,000. So, you know, we got two-thirds of the November turnout in a primary when they're just casting one vote. It's right. Pretty amazing. Other states can never touch us, and that's one reason why New Hampshire has an argument about going first, because we do it so well that people get so involved, and it's a small enough state, both in people and in geography, that a relatively unknown person can meet enough voters that they get. The voter gets to know the candidate gets to know the voters, and it's a real considered judgment. I'd also point out maybe part of the reason for the low turnout in Iowa is it's a caucus where you're supposed to go there and, you know, rally support for your person. And with so many good people running, there were so many undecided people. A lot of them probably stayed home. It's like, I don't know who I'm going to support, so why would I go to a caucus?
Well, and actually, not only that, but Stephen, not only that, but then you have to stand up saying, I don't know. I mean, that's part right. of the problem. At least I could go into my voting booth, and I told this to Ken. I went into the voting booth. I had my pencil in my hand. I literally had tears rolling down my cheeks, and I looked at that piece of paper for at least 2 or 3 minutes because I hadn't decided yet. I mean, that's irony. That I would actually go in. So imagine having to do something and announce from the minute you walk in, you know, what corner of the room you're going to be in front of all these different people, and you have to be there at 7 o'clock at night. But Stephen Pimpare, what is so fascinating to me is that Nevada was going to use the same app. No, they're not. And that Nevada also does something different from the Iowa caucus in that you can actually start voting early while it will then be applied to whatever precinct you're supposed to go to. But they actually sort of do this interesting blend of a primary and a caucus by allowing this concept of voting early. I know that Iowa had satellite, you know, places to vote in places like meatpacking plants and whatever that they'd never done before.
And overseas as well.
But this is really sort of an interesting blend where people are actually already voting in the caucus, even though technically a caucus is where you're supposed to be physically present, but they're going to only have their vote physically present. Stephen?
I think any system that requires anyone to show up at a particular place and time is inherently undemocratic because it discriminates against people who do not have that kind of control over their lives. So I think that is the argument for why an Iowa-style caucus simply should not exist and should be abolished and removed from the earth, and salt should be spread so nothing grows in its place. I think the problem with Nevada
sounds good to
is
me.
that it avoids some of those kinds of problems, but nonetheless has this extraordinarily arcane Byzantine method of calculating votes and support that presents, I think, another set of problems for sort of basic democratic transparency. I think given all of that, the one lesson that I would take away from New Hampshire, and I think I know this is heresy now that I live here, but there is no good justification for New Hampshire having the outsized influence that it does. However, the lesson, I think, is paper ballots, paper ballots.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And that's exactly what I was trying to reinforce in every single damn setting I was in, Dean Spiliotis. I mean, I had my number two pencil in hand all the time. And it wasn't just about that. But it does show that the primary matters. And I'm going to sort of – we've had this conversation on and off during the course of the last week because you know that Iowa's toast. They know that. It's gone. The caucus is gone. And I think Iowa as a state, as a starting state, is gone. The real question that we've had is, and I actually had an interesting sort of active discourse with Chris Sununu when we were both doing uplinks at St. A's about whether New Hampshire should continue to go first and whether we're going to throw Iowa under the bus, which will then leave New Hampshire there, or whether we're so married to each other, Iowa, New Hampshire, you say it in one breath. And the idea is if you're going to upset the apple cart, you're going to change how we do caucuses or, frankly, how we do primaries going forward. I suspect that they probably will have to separate both of us out and then do something different, because I think you can't argue for one and not for the other, in part because we're old, we're white, and I know they're going to
try.
But let's remember, and Mark, remember this, we are the second oldest state in the nation. We are 91% white. We are the seventh richest state in the nation. I mean, diversity, we have no idea about. We're kind of a suburb of Boston.
Which is probably the most reliable voting demographic in the country, actually, which is why we have such high turnout.
Right, but it is the most reliable, but doesn't reflect where we are as a nation. And I think the idea of small states are important. The idea of primaries are important, but I'm not sure Dean Spiliotis, that we can be the only one to lay claim to.
Well, you can't make the diversity argument.
You can't.
That's just the reality of the situation. But you can make an argument about New Hampshire functioning as kind of a microcosm of democratic participation and democracy. And there are a lot of good things about the way we do it here in terms of vetting candidates.
And we serve
turnout,
you maple syrup,
et cetera.
You can come to the Red Arrow.
It's a fun place to do a campaign. And it's easy. As I think as the campaigns are finding out now, it's nice to have everything in this sort of compact state. You know, maybe, who knows, maybe if Nevada does a good job, they'll cut Iowa loose and just put Nevada in front of us and South Carolina behind us, and then everybody will be happy. Nevada, New Hampshire, South Carolina.
Okay, everyone listening? Everybody listening? Anyway, but we don't want caucuses. They're too crazy, and we haven't yet seen the results in Nevada. And I want to go to Nevada now, because what's interesting is that the very, very powerful union in Nevada decided not to endorse, okay? But one of the things they did do, and I'll turn to you, Stephen Pimpare, is while they didn't endorse, they did trash Bernie. And I mean the leadership trash Bernie, because of his Medicare for All, basically saying that this is how we negotiate. This is so important. We want that choice. Our membership understands it. So what I think is so fascinating is, first of all, they're suggesting that no one that's in that union is going to listen to the leadership, because they're distinguishing between what the leadership says, which is their negotiating skills, and what the membership knows. And let me be honest with you, Stephen. I've lost my health care four times, you know, and I don't care whether I had a union or didn't have a union or had a job or didn't have a job. I know that there's nothing about a permanent job, and most of us will have anywhere from 7 to 15 jobs over the course of a lifetime. And the idea that my union saves me when I'm employed with a union doesn't mean that I'm saved when I'm losing that job and I have to look around for another job. So I think it's really interesting to see how the membership is translating Medicare for All versus how the leadership is translating Medicare for All. And it shows, I think, a fascinating disconnect between the reality of their lives and what the leadership wants, which is to keep their power.
And there's nothing particularly new or surprising, I would argue, about that. If we look at explanations for why is it that the United States has so much more sort of for-profit, private, employer-based insurance sitting at the system compared to other rich democracies, part of the answer is that early in the 20th century, one of the things that unions were effective at winning was employer-provided health insurance. And looking at every significant effort, the 30s, the 40s, a little bit in the 50s, the 60s, on in particularly to the 90s and more forward, you will often see certain unions fighting for broader access to health care because they are defending their own territory that was hard won for them. And I get that, right? And you can see sort of this is the way in which leadership of that union often is encouraging members to fight for broader access for fear that they will lose something as a result. This is a very old story and a very old play by certain unions.
But of course, remember that And the unions need to remember that the leadership negotiated better health insurance plans at the cost of lower wage increases.
Right, exactly.
So,
exactly.
You know, it was a win-win for the employer and the union leadership because nobody in the company wanted to pay higher wages, and the union could still win something for the workers by getting the expense of health care premiums.
Mark, just make sure I understand this correctly. So if I'm working as a union boss, okay, I'm the head of the union, whatever, I'm kind of permanently employed as long as I'm working for the union. But the people that are actually in the union are not permanently employed. They are left up to the whim of their employers if they close a casino or they decide to hire somebody else. So the union guys, when they negotiate these things, they get it as long as they're sort of in the union and in control of the union. But the union workers, you know, they're basically at the whim of the employer. So if the employer decides, I'm going to close down this casino or I'm going to move you to, you know, Cucamonga and don't need you anymore, they lose all those great benefits, and now they're on their own, Jack. You know, now they have to figure out whether they can afford COBRA. Now they have to look for another job, and they have to hope that the next job not only does it give them a paycheck, but that it gives them, you know, some kind of health benefits that usually don't kick in for 3 to 6 months. So it's so interesting, the disconnect between what employees need and what the union negotiates, Mark.
You're presupposing, Arnie, that the leadership doesn't represent accurately the membership. And I guess I would not make that assumption. And yes, there are people who are unionized who are going to lose jobs. There are people who are not unionized who are going to lose jobs. Paul Krugman cites the statistic that every month an average of 75,000 Americans are laid off. Mm-hmm. 75,000 people per month.
Right.
It's a constant churn in the job market. And so do some union people lose their jobs? Of course they do. But that doesn't mean that the union as a whole is not supportive of the health plan they have and want to keep it. And I think that it's a real – I mean, going from the specific to the general, I think it's a real issue whether – Medicare for All is what we want to be front and center in the presidential campaign, knowing that there are people who are apprehensive that either they're going to lose their health insurance and they don't know what's going to replace it, or they don't know what it's going to cost. That is it going to cost them more, is it going to cost them less? They just don't know. And when people don't know, they will be conservative and vote for no change. And that, to me, is a real danger for the Democratic Party. I think we'd be much smarter if we campaigned on universal health insurance and we'll work out the details after we win, rather than saying this is the only possible solution and it's a complete revolution in health care and watch out.
So let me just ask Dean Spilios, I've got two things here. I think you're going to be proven wrong that there is a disconnect between the leadership and the membership. If you look at Politico, I think this is absolutely right. Politico has a piece that says Bernie breaks out of the pack. In Nevada, rival campaigns privately concede the race is for second or third place. Mm-hmm. And if he breaks out of the pack, it's because there was a disconnect between what the leadership was sort of channeling and what the membership is going to actually do. But number two, let me just say something. AOC basically said that she knows that maybe Bernie cannot get Medicare for All.
Yeah, this is what I was
but
just thinking.
Yeah, there you go. So why don't you share with our audience Bernie and be actually coming through the voice of his very liberal follower AOC has actually said out loud.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the argument with Bernie is that, you know, he can be ideologically pure and consistent on his support for Medicare for All, but a lot of people argue that it's just not going to happen unless we see an incredibly significant change in the composition of Congress. There's just no way to get it through Congress right now. So AOC was asked about this.
Right?
And, you know, because a lot of people think part of the, you know, Elizabeth Warren, who we can talk about later, you know, she tried to back away a little bit and say, well, we'll transition.
She got
and
slapped out.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't help her. People thought that's what she needed to do.
She
it
looked
ended up
weak.
Right.
She looked weak.
Yeah, just
she's, as opposed to honest.
She was, I mean, in fairness to her, she was just kind of stuck. She was getting either way. So, but AOC said, well, okay, so yeah, we don't get Medicare for All. At least we'll probably have single payer.
So, Stephen, you know what bothers me is that if you read Bernie's plan, it's a 4-year step towards Medicare for All. It takes him 4 years. 4 years. He doesn't do it in the first year, number one. Number two, Stephen Pimper, he voted for the Affordable Care Act. Oh, he wasn't a purist. He didn't die on his sword. It wasn't Medicare for all. What was he doing? Oh-ish, Stephen Pimper. He compromised.
You know, and I think the other thing to throw into the mix here is that there are no two people on the planet who mean the same thing when they say Medicare for all, right? That that plays out in a thousand different ways. And as you've all alluded to, you know, should one of these folks actually become president and they have large enough Democratic majorities even to have serious conversations, lots of that will be actually hashed out in the legislative process. So it then becomes what's sort of the good strategy, right? What is the messaging take? And, you know, no one is paying me to advise a campaign, but I do wonder if they all wouldn't be more effective de-emphasizing the alternative and focusing on the known reality of the fact that the Trump administration is in court now trying to literally repeal all of the Affordable Care Act and every one of its provisions.
Mark, that's exactly what you're saying, I think, too, as well. And I do want to point out that I posted something on my Facebook page, Mark, and what I posted was the German model, which is not Medicare for all, which still has some form of sort of private nonprofit insurance, and yet everybody is covered. The cost of going to a hospital is $11. You never spend more than 2% for copays and deductibles, and everyone's a happy camper, and it's amazing. But we weren't even allowed to discuss other things, in part because Bernie drove the conversation, Medicare for all or status quo, and actually that's not true. Am I right, Mark?
That's absolutely true. And Germany's not the only country that has universal coverage, but not a single-payer system. Arnie, I want to jump on one other thing you said, because you were quoting some, I think it was Politico, that Bernie is surging in Nevada. Before the Iowa caucuses, at least what I saw in the media, Bernie's 10 points ahead of everybody else, and then it ends up a tie. Mm-hmm. And then before the New Hampshire primary, there was a lot of media. Bernie is, you know, way out in front. He's from a neighboring state. And again, it was almost a tie. So I don't know what's happening in Nevada, but we shouldn't pay a lot of attention to the horse race stuff. You know, the voters are going to speak.
Amen.
And it may
all
not
right.
be what the pollsters
say. All right. Next week, we'll have a conversation. Anyway, I need to do a little labor history. This is Rethink the Week, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day that working people in the United States said goodbye to one of their great heroes. Florence Kelly was born in 1859. Her father, William D. Kelly, was a U.S. senator. Senator Kelly was an abolitionist and was concerned about the conditions under which working people toiled. He passed that concern on to his daughter. Florence enjoyed the finest education, studying at Cornell University, the University of Zurich, and the Union College of Law. She became a vocal opponent of child labor and sweatshop conditions. She found camaraderie with like-minded women, including Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr at Hull House in Chicago. Kelly soon became an important addition to the work of this famed settlement house. Jane Addams' nephew remembered her as the finest rough-and-tumble fighter for the good life of others that Hull House ever knew. She began to visit local factories around Hull House to document unsafe working conditions and the use of child labor. Based on her careful research, the Illinois legislature passed a law banning children under the age of 14 from working in factories. Florence was named the first ever chief factory inspector in the state of Illinois. From Chicago, she moved on to New York, where she helped to found the National Consumer League. The league supported the fight for the 8-hour workday and was a leader in the fight against sweatshops. Florence was also a founding member of the NAACP. She helped to found the National Child Labor Committee, a group dedicated to ending child labor. In response to their work, in 1912, the U.S. Children's Bureau became part of the federal government. It was the only federal agency at the time run by women. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. overlooks the Tidal Basin, a man-made body of water surrounded by cherry trees. Visitors can stroll along the water's edge, gazing up at the stately monument. But at high tide, people are forced off parts of the path. Twice a day, the Tidal Basin floods, and water spills onto the walkway. One problem is that the land is sinking. But as the climate warms, sea levels are also rising, and the flooding gets even worse during extreme storms, which are growing more common.
The whole entire National Mall sits in the 100-year floodplain. It's particularly vulnerable to all the challenges that we face.
Teresa Durkin is Executive Vice President of the Trust for the National Mall. To start addressing the problem, the Trust has brought together five design firms to reimagine the Tidal Basin's future.
Perhaps the Tidal Basin gets smaller. Perhaps some of the pathways become bridges. Maybe perhaps we'll create some new wetlands here.
She says preserving this national treasure in its current form is no longer an option.
There's got to be new thinking about how we do things and how we protect these important places.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Very real, and what a hope and happiness. Are they forever lost? Or we just step in and prevent another Holocaust? Oh, everybody better wake up. Everybody better wake up. The superpowers better wake up. The world powers better wake up.
All right, everyone, wake up. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. This is why you tune into the show. We wake you up every Monday.
And Tuesday,
this?
Wednesday,
and
Thursday.
Of course. And Friday. We do the whole dog and pony
show. Yeah, so Wake Up is the Neville Brothers from the Yellow Moon album.
Terribly wonderful. Joining us in studio is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Joining us by phone is Mark Fernald, a former state senator, a former candidate for governor, a supporter of Mayor Pete. And also on the line is Stephen Pimpere. He is a professor at UNH Manchester and a fellow at the Carsey Institute. Area of expertise is poverty and homelessness. And gentlemen, I have Dean Spiliotis checking his little iPhone. And why don't you share with the audience, the Twitter, and share with the audience what Michael Bloomberg has just placed in an ad? Because after all, when you have billions to spend and time on your hands, what can you do to people like Bernie Sanders? So tell them what
they did. Just to give you a sense of how nasty this is getting quite quickly, and I don't know if this is a TV ad. It may just be one of these social media digital pieces that they put up, and then it gets disseminated around. So, Bernie Sanders has said that he doesn't believe that Bloomberg has the right kind of energy to lead the Democratic Party in November. And so the Bloomberg folks put up a tweet with a attached video that says, "Oh, do you mean you need this kind of energy?" And it's a minute of screenshots of all the horrible things that Sanders supporters have said about the other candidates. And I mean,
really
nasty,
brutal,
filthy, scary stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that's where we're headed. And it's interesting. I was talking to a couple friends just recently, and they were saying that talking about the Democratic race is increasingly feeling like talking about the Republican race in 2016. Trump, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Is he a Republican or is he really a Democrat? And now in the Democratic Party, we got Bloomberg. Is he a Republican or a Democrat? Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Bernie, he's not really a Democrat or is he a Democrat? And so it's just, we feel like it's amazing how the narrative, the Bloomberg and Bernie stuff is just really dominating the kind of discourse right now. And the other candidates are just kind of doing their thing and, we'll see what happens.
So Mark, I decided that I want to do a commercial. Of course, I don't have billions of dollars and I can't do a commercial, but if I could do a commercial, here is the commercial I want to do. Remember the show To Tell the Truth? Remember that show, Mark? You remember that show,
I do.
Of course.
Arlene Francis.
Yeah. Can I play?
We're all of the appropriate age to remember that show. Yeah.
And I want everyone playing Michael Bloomberg. And I want one of the candidates, one of the people playing Michael Bloomberg going, "I'm Michael Bloomberg. civil libertarians and teachers' unions are like the NRA extremists. I'm Michael Bloomberg. The reason why there was the economic meltdown of 2008 is because we basically got rid of redlining. I'm Michael Bloomberg. I believe in stop and frisk. I mean, I think it would be – I mean, the difference – let me just say something. I am not in any way, shape, or form supporting, endorsing, encouraging the supporters of Bernie Sanders to go over the top and to basically be horrific. I mean, horrific. I mean, I think it's wrong. Shut up. I'll wash your mouth out with soap. But they're his supporters. This is out of the mouth of the candidate, Michael Bloomberg. Imagine if we did to tell the truth and everybody's saying they're Michael Bloomberg, literally saying what he said in 2013, in 2011, in 22, frankly, in 2018. You know, he has a bedside conversion, but what is the real Michael Bloomberg? And that's really what I want to know, Mark Fernald.
Well, maybe we're going to find out. Maybe we're not. I would point out that if the party is trying to win the middle, and Bloomberg, not just in his positioning, but in things he said in the past, you know, doesn't set himself out on the far left or even the middle far left. You know, he could well win the nomination, and I think if he does, I think he beats Trump because he's taken over the middle and he's willing to mix it up with Trump. I mean, you know, the teachers union is a good example of him picking the middle rather than just saying, you know, whatever organized labor says, I agree with. We've probably all seen the articles about that room in New York City where teachers who have been kicked out of the classroom go and bide their time playing cards and reading and get paid full pay. Because, I don't know, there's some lengthy appeal process as to whether they should ever teach again. And, you know, that's what the union has required in their contract. And I think almost every taxpayer would think there's something wrong with that.
Okay. Okay. Now, how many teachers are we talking about there?
That's,
I mean,
not
Mark. Mark,
terrible thing.
Right. Let me just say something, Mark. And he didn't just say that teachers' unions are like the NRA extremists. He said civil libertarians are like the NRA extremists. So what government teat have they been sucking on?
Well, you know, what I was going to say is the ACLU are, I'm going to put quotes around it, they are extremists. They are exactly the kind of extremists we want because they ask the tough questions every time.
Right.
And it's great that they're there. But they, you know, they are on the extreme, at least compared to the average person. You know, they're protecting the Nazis and then they're protecting somebody else. And, you know, the average person would never do that. But we need them.
All right, so Stephen, I'm trying to figure out here, and I was asked this question. I was called by some media in Washington D.C. about exactly what's happening with that ad that Bloomberg just put out. Okay, about the supporters of Bernie who have really gone over the top and attacked in a way that is actually outrageous. So I have children, actually. So does Joe Biden. He has a son named Hunter. His claim was that Hunter was an adult and he couldn't control him, and that it wasn't his job to control him. So the fact that he worked for the Ukrainian, you know, oil and gas, you know, oligarch, really, even though he was working on the Ukrainian policy for the administration, he had no control over his son vis-a-vis his job in Ukraine. So I just got to ask this question, Stephen Pimper. So I want Bernie to tap it down. I want him to say, you are undermining our ability to win. How do we bring a country together? I think I want him to be a little more overt in basically telling him that. But can I be honest with you? What does he do to stop them in a country where you just mentioned, actually, Mark just mentioned the civil libertarians? How do I stop them in other than just discouraging them from doing it? Stephen?
Well, I mean, we fall into this trap every election cycle, right? We wind up focusing on narrative and personality, and there's a boatload of political science that says if that sort of stuff matters, it matters around the edges at best. And I think when we're talking about Bloomberg, the essential question is the one that raises profound questions about the nature of the electoral process itself, right? As of this morning, the last number I could come up was that Bloomberg has spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $420 million so far far. That's twice what Tom Steyer has spent, the other billionaire in the race, and more than 10 times what any of the other non-billionaire candidates has spent. And he is spending in novel ways, literally paying people to go online and support him. He is putting ads up in states where there are literally no other candidates and where voters have no real knowledge about the candidates. They're not tuned in as we are. They're not paying attention yet. So he has this way to sort of dominate the debate in ways that are unusual. There's been all sorts of stuff on Twitter and other social media about the sheer volume of people who he has hired who are, again, reaching out to voters in utterly novel ways, not just in terms of the style, but in terms of the scope. And I think that, for me, is the much more important question, right? To what extent does the democratic process become so deeply corrupted that we can't talk about meaningful choice among most voters?
So I'm going to ask Dean a question. So, Dean, we had an amazing conversation on Tuesday with John Nichols from The Nation magazine, who lives in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. with Scott Braddock, who lives in Texas, and with Rob Hennelly, who's covered Mayor Bloomberg since the very beginning from New York. Okay. So it's just incredible. So one of the things that we learned, this is sort of to build on what Stephen just said, was that there is this prime location in Madison, Wisconsin, right in the center of Madison. And, of course, whose headquarters is it now? It is Bloomberg's. Bloomberg has, I think, hired already 60 people in Madison, Wisconsin, including, I think, the former either chair of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin or the executive director. The other thing Bloomberg has done—
You're paying good salaries,
yes,
too.
Yes, that was I was going right there.
It's not a bad gig.
Yeah, it's not like $10,000 to $12,000 a month, yeah. You know, something they've never— And I am just trying to figure out, how do you explain to people, is this what democracy is about— Or are we so exhausted that we are prepared to put democracy on hiatus and be bought? Because this is an acquisition campaign, and yes, it's influence, but influence at a level that is like 98% marketing and expenditure, and we're supposed to ignore everything that he was. And frankly, he's 78 years old. Did you know that? He is as old as Bernie Sanders. Have I heard anyone—
Bernie's going to be 79 in September.
Oh, yes. Oh, there's a four-month difference.
But still, they're both pushing 80, yes.
No, they're both— But has anyone brought out the fact that he's 78? Has anyone asked him about his health, and has he had a heart attack?
No.
I don't know anything about his health. So it's interesting what the money also does is it builds a moat around you where certain questions never get asked because they don't seem meaningful because all that's meaning is the money he's spending.
Yeah, well, you know, our history, if you go back, you know, several hundred years, there have been these moments periodically where the presidential selection process has transformed or been reformed or in some fundamental way changed. And, you know, we had the McGovern-Frazier reforms in 72, so that's almost 50 years ago now, to move us towards this more decentralized and participatory system of primaries and caucuses. You know, it may be time for reconsideration. We don't know. We have to kind of see how things play out. But what I will say is, the criticism against a national primary day or rotating regional primaries has been that it'll nationalize the process, it'll put too much emphasis on money, we'll lose the kind of decentralized participatory nature of the primaries and caucuses. We're kind of sort of getting that now. We're getting a feel for what that would be like
exactly.
Now. This is all like
that's
really nationalized.
Brilliant. Write that op-ed. That's okay. Brilliant.
So we're almost like partway to a national primary at this point.
Right. And the person
maybe.
Who's... Maybe. All right,
yeah,
Mark.
Maybe.
Go on,
maybe,
Mark.
Yeah.
Mark.
Well, look at how much money Steyer spent in New Hampshire, and he came in what? Six?
Yeah.
Oh no! But
so we don't know the effect of Bloomberg's money yet.
Yeah, we don't.
We're
we
talking
don't.
About
no,
it.
We
no,
may
no,
find
no. I'm going to disabuse you of that. Because Steyer played the game like everybody else. He allowed people to contribute to his campaign. He worked in the primaries. He didn't ignore the initial primaries. He was very transparent about everything he's been doing since the beginning and campaigning like a normal candidate, but for the fact that he's spending, you know, lots of money. What Bloomberg is doing is he's doing flyover. He is ignoring it. He bought. I believe it. I can't prove it, everyone. I know he bought those three write-ins in Dixville Notch. I know it.
Well, he did talk with them.
Of course he did.
He talked with all the Dixville Notch people just to answer any questions
there
they might have before.
So understand.
I don't know what he offered them, but he talked to them.
Well, and there you go. So Mark, he won the New Hampshire primary before anybody else won the New Hampshire primary, getting those three votes from Dixville Notch because he was the only headline coming out of New Hampshire for almost 14 hours because he was able to do that.
But doesn't that go to the question of whether this is the kind of democracy you want? Because shouldn't the media why would the media cover five voters in Dixville Notch anyway? Who gives a crap about what they think?
And then Stephen. Mark?
I was just going to say, you know, is Bloomberg doing it different? You know, maybe you say it's a flyover campaign. Let's be honest, when we get to the fall, it's a flyover and it's a fly in and out of the tarmac campaign. So, I mean, maybe he's doing the same style campaign we're going to see from July and August until November. So maybe he's getting some practice. I don't know.
So, Stephen, I want to change the subject because I don't want to be dominated by him anyway. I want to go to Bill Barr. And I'm looking at the Atlantic Monthly. And the Atlantic Monthly has a headline that's entitled, Bill Barr Must Resign. The Attorney General is working to destroy the integrity and independence of the Justice Department in order to make Donald Trump a president who can operate above the law. So I was listening to a number of shows on television and reading some articles. It has not been uncommon for there to be a relationship between the president and the attorney general. And maybe we're shocked because we don't know our history to know about that. But what I'm trying to figure out is whether this is different, what Barr is doing with Donald Trump, as opposed to what we have seen in the past, because this does feel a little more intense. And I feel like, you know, Donald Trump, basically, whether he does it in code by tweet or whether he takes Barr out for dinner or writes it on a napkin, that Bill Barr basically is aiding and abetting really the wish list of Donald Trump.
I mean, as with so much in the Trump administration, right, it becomes a question of, is this a difference in kind or is this a difference in degree? And I think the answer here is this is a difference in degree, as in so much else, right?
Right.
These are behaviors that we can trace back to lots and lots of Justice Departments, including those that Bill Barr has served in and headed under previous presidents. But I think part of the difference is the larger context, right? This sort of growing awareness among people who should have known better that there is genuinely no respect whatsoever for the rule of law, for ordinary democratic processes and such in the Trump administration, and that increasingly the agencies in the executive branch are adopting that approach and dispelling even the pretense of neutral arbitration of the law and asserting that, as Nixon would tell us, if the president does it, it's not illegal.
Yeah.
Well, let me just read you something, Dean Spiliotis. This is, again, from the Atlantic Monthly. Among the most widely reported and disturbing events have been Barr's statements that a judicially authorized FBI investigation amounted to spying on the Trump campaign and his public rejection in December of the Inspector General's considered conclusion that the Russian probe was properly initiated and overseen in an unbiased manner. Also quite unsettling was Trump's explicit mention of Barr and Rudy Giuliani in the same breath in his July 25th phone call with Zelensky as individuals the Ukraine president should speak with regarding the phony investigation that Ukraine was expected to publicly announce. I mean, it's almost at every turn, Barr is pivotal in the statements or the actions of the Trump administration, which is enhancing his power, suggesting he is above the law. And Barr just feels like a handmaiden to it. He just doesn't want Trump to be so overt because he's carrying it out anyway. You don't need to tell me, darling. I know exactly what to do. I mean, I feel that's really what Barr is sort of saying. And yet the reaction from so many people outside the administration plus inside the administration suggests that this is profoundly wrong, but it just seems like if you support Donald Trump, you want him to be that untouchable despot.
Well, you know, I think it's a fair point that you make that there have been these moments over the last, since Barr was appointed, where these pivotal moments where, as an institutionalist, the expectation would be he would take us in one direction, but instead he at least initially kind of shocked people by going in the other direction and kind of taking up a personal approach to representing Donald Trump, as Attorney General, which is what he's been all the complaint is about. And I think a good test is going to be Andrew McCabe. I'm sure yes. Trump was apoplectic when the Justice Department said they're not going to prosecute McCabe or charge McCabe, and I'm
because
sure
the grand jury
Trump's going to be sort of trying to figure out how to kind of work around that decision, we'll see how Barr handles it. But there's just been it's funny. I remember back when he was first coming in, and everybody said, "Oh, you know, he's an institutionalist. He's got this great record, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Don't worry, he's going to protect the integrity of the Justice Department." And it's been anything but that thus far.
So, Mark, I just want to reinforce: you are the lawyer in the group, the practicing attorney, and so is Ken. I'm not a practicing; I don't practice. I never took
the
bar.
I'm not an attorney at all.
No, exactly.
Ken's an attorney too.
Ken's an attorney.
So everybody except for me is an attorney.
No. Steven's not as well.
Oh, Steven's not.
Okay,
so
it's
avoided law school any number of times.
Right. I dropped out too often. So Mark, I'm going to ask you. I think what is so shocking is that he was not, in fact, indicted by the grand jury. Because as we know, and that's the common line that, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich, but they really do have a relatively low standard compared to what will happen in a trial. And the fact that they could not indict him is shocking to me, but it also suggests, oh my God, how desperate is this administration to throw everything at a wall to hope it sticks? And when they couldn't find it in their heart and their soul to do it, it tells you that this is an act of desperation on a part of an administration that has really gone off to an incredible extreme.
You were talking about Barr, and is he just completely taking the president's side? Look at his cabinet appointees, the ones who have left. Think about Jeff Sessions, who, whatever you think of his politics, he was trying to at least to some extent being independent. He stepped back from the Mueller investigation. You look at Mattis at defense, who, was trying to listen to the rest of the generals about what we should do and should not do. And, eventually Trump's answer to all those people is, "You're fired," like on the TV show, because ultimately I want you to do what I want you to do. I don't care what all the experts say.
Right.
And so is it a surprise that he ends up with Barr, who's this entirely in his camp? No, it's not a surprise. The other thing I would say is what we're learning in these Trump years is something about our system. I think we all kind of believe growing up, learning about the American democracy, that we're special because of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and our Constitution.
We're special, exactly.
And what we're finding is, maybe I still think we are special, but a lot of what made us special was sort of the rules of conduct and principles that
normed
below the constitutional level.
Because
there are countries like Russia and China where they have, quote, freedom of speech in their constitution, and yet they don't have it. And it's because of the corrupting influence of the top that reaches down to the prosecutors and the judges and everybody. And we have not had that. And Trump wants us to have that so that he controls everybody.
So the piece that I was reading, Stephen, is by Donald Ayer at The Atlantic. He served as the U.S. Attorney and Principal Deputy Solicitor General in the Reagan administration and was a deputy AG under George H.W. Bush. And his last line in his piece is, "Bill Barr's America is not a place that anyone, including Trump voters, should want to go. It is a banana republic where all are subject to the whims of a dictatorial president and his henchmen. To prevent that, we need a public uprising demanding that Bill Barr resign immediately or, failing that, be impeached." Look at who wrote this, Stephen. They're shocked because they don't recognize it. But I want to go back to what Mark said. It was not based on the law. It was based on norms. We somehow thought that the norms would hold. And clearly, in a time of upheaval, in the greatest gap between rich and poor, you know, people basically dying younger, not being able to afford their drugs, the rise of the opioid crisis, climate change. We are living in such a turbulent world that there is no safe harbor. So why should norms stick, Stephen?
And I think, you know, certain people have always overstated the extent to which those norms have kept things civilized. You know, in Star, you mentioned the Reagan administration. Start with Iran-Contra, right? Congress enacts a law that explicitly forbids the administration from doing something. Mm-hmm. So in order to do it anyway, right, rejecting the very notion of separation of powers, it engages in illegal weapons sales to Iran, uses the proceeds to fund an illegal war. This is how we get Iran-Contra. And this is also one of the ways in which we know Bill Barr, right, because he helped advise the administration in order to pardon the guilty parties so that they couldn't further expose the corruption in the Reagan and Bush administration. So I think we should always be careful about overstating the nobility of the American Constitution and its history, particularly as we're thinking about Bloomberg and the experience of young black men living in that city. It was arguably little different than America in the South under Jim Crow.
And while we're talking about that and also the upheaval, I just want to say that when you all were talking about the Democratic primary and whatnot, you were talking about the money and the campaign results, but I think that we really need to have a conversation about what values and policy the Democratic Party is going to transform itself into. Because that's the real struggle that I see going on in the Democratic campaigns is what kind of party and what kind of country do we want to be? Do we want to be one where there's so much inequality?
A banana republic.
Yeah,
exactly.
And so much trampling on constitutional rights. And
so I'm going to just ask Dean one follow-up. This is our STEM wonder question. You get to end the show, Dean. So why isn't there been an upheaval and a rising on the streets? We had that huge women's march after Donald Trump got elected. This seems to be hitting every silo in America. I mean, who hasn't been hurt? Who hasn't been offended? Who hasn't been trampled on? We have what's happened with NPR and the media. We had what's happened with Bill Barr and justice. We've had what's happened to climate and the environment. We've had what's happened to immigrants and Hispanics. Every single group, he has a wish list. Who can I screw? Let's do it. And yet when you do it to everyone, nobody decides to pour into the streets because we're all being accosted. Isn't that kind of
shocking? Yeah, well, that's interesting. You know, I think part of it is that all that energy that you just mentioned is being channeled into the electoral process. And right now, Democrats are fragmented, so it's hard to come together in that sort of fashion. And I think that's part of it. I think part of it is so much of this now is in our lives is kind of virtual, online, and social media. So, I talk to plenty of people who feel like they're doing battle every day. And, I say, where? And they're like, well, Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, exactly,
I'm fighting back on Instagram and Twitter. So I think there are multiple reasons for that, but that's a fair point.
All right. I need to let you go. This is Rethink the Week. It's Monday. Stephen Pimper, UNH, Carsey Institute, Mark Fernald, former state senator, former candidate for governor in New Hampshire, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. We end with?
By the way, there has been some pushback, the Women's March, and there's been a lot of other stuff. But we end with, which side are you on?
Totally appropriate. Here we go, everyone.
Good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We've started our good battle, we know we're sure to win, because we've got the gun thugs looking very thin. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? They say they have to guard us to educate their child. Their children lives in luxury, our children's almost wild. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? With pistols and with rifles, they take away our
our bread. And if you miners hinted it, they'd beat you on the head. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go up to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?